Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There's a sign at the airport here in Dubai that says, "Welcome to tomorrow." Nice touch, right, from the city that's trying to be the world's economic future. But what about the future of the Middle East? From American Public Media and live from Dubai, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
Great to have you with us once again for the Middle East at Work. I'm Kai Rizdal in Dubai. It is Friday today, the 14th of March. And let's bring the week to a close down at Dubai Creek. It's where our series started, on little boats called Abras, ferrying migrant workers back and forth across the water. Just upstream, there's an entirely different kind of commerce going on. Dozens, maybe hundreds of dhows, traditional Arabian cargo ships, are tied up. They stretch all along the seawall and out into the creek, four or five abreast. But you can barely see them behind the mountains of cargo waiting to be loaded.
We got printed bed sheets, we've got garlic, we've got one-ply napkins, we've got palm olive natural shampoos, we've got baby wipes, and we got tires. We got more tires than we know what to do with.
Think for a second about where we are on the map, right inside the Persian Gulf, a perfect distribution point for this part of the world. Iran is less than 100 miles away. All of East Africa is practically right around the corner, which is where these boxes of sandals are going.
Somalia, Somalia.
There are, seriously, thousands of those boxes, stamped Made in China on one side, Dubai for export on the other. They're being loaded by migrant workers.
From Pakistan.
And swung aboard by crane and cargo net. If you were looking for a snapshot of the Middle East's place in the global economy, it doesn't get any better than this. Goods and capital coming in, goods and capital going out. And increasingly, the U.S. nowhere in sight. Marketplace's Scott Tong picks up the story from the Chinese port city of Qingdao.
About 20 times every day, a container ship pulls into Qingdao in northeastern China, and the port comes alive. Workers scramble to anchor the ship, and then cranes unload the containers. Dubai Ports World, a company owned by Dubai, helps run the port terminal under a partnership with the local government. It holds stakes in two other Chinese ports, and it wants more to cash in on China's booming cargo traffic, or throughput, says the company's senior vice president, Peter Wong.
The China container throughput is basically one-fourth of the global container throughput. Now, the question is very simple. Can you ignore a market of this size?
Trade between the Middle East and China shot up tenfold the past decade. The name Dubai Ports World sounds familiar to many Americans. 2 years back, it tried to buy U.S. port terminals. But Republican Congressman Duncan Hunter and many others slammed the deal as a national security threat.
Let's let people buy apartments in Chicago or farmland in Iowa, but they can't own and operate port operations.
Jonas Lindblad manages Gulf Money for the private equity firm Jade Invest. He says DP World sold off its U.S. assets, but it wasn't the only Arab investor to do so.
Let's not kid ourselves. The DP World issue was driven primarily by the origin of the investor. That factor actually led to a wave of divestment out of the West. It's still very disputed as to the magnitude of that divestment, but that it has happened is very clear to me.
Consulting firm McKinsey expects Middle East investors to shift up to a third of their portfolios to Asia. That's around $250 billion in the next 5 years. Lindblad considers China less hostile politically and safer economically.
If you look at the state of the U.S. economy, U.S. is not the country with the largest foreign reserves in the world. That's the country we're sitting now.
Here in Qingdao, Dubai's DP World has put $500 million into a port expansion. and his sister company plans a high-end property development. The big bet is on Chinese consumers, the young people toting shopping bags along Qingdao's pedestrian-only shopping strip. By some estimates, China's middle class is 150 million strong and growing. For all the Gulf money starting to come east, China is sending exports back. No, not just low-end T-shirts and toys, but lately, China brand cars. Domestic Chinese automaker Li Fan promotes a poor man's Honda Civic in Egypt, Syria, and Iran. At $13,000, it's $5,000 cheaper than the Japanese competition. Li Fan executive Zhu Xiaomen.
Compared with big foreign companies, our technology is lacking, and so is our quality. But in the Middle East, customers have lower standards for quality than in the U.S. and European markets.
Li Fan plans to advertise heavily in the Gulf and other emerging markets, and then in 3 years, graduate to the North American big leagues. Again, private equity manager Jonas Lindblad.
I think it makes perfect sense for the Chinese to give that kind of priority to the Middle East, and it fits very well within the agenda of the Middle East as well, which is rapid expansion, very focused on cost and price. And that is what the Chinese can deliver.
Big dreams like these have some observers predicting a modern-day Silk Road between the Middle East and the old Far East, a road that runs neither through Europe nor North America. In Qingdao, northeastern China, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Nothing like a little federal bailout to get people talking about giant cracks in the financial system, huh? The news this morning that J.P. Morgan and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York are going to prop up Bear Stearns got everybody's attention. You might remember it was the collapse of two Bear Stearns hedge funds last spring that started the subprime ball rolling down toward recession. Usually when the U.S. economy slides, so slides the rest of the world. Commentator Robert Reich says that's not going to happen this time, thanks to China and the Middle East.
Much of the Middle East is swimming in oil money, petrodollars, while China has built up its own huge stock of savings, call them sino-dollars. These petrodollars and sino-dollars aren't just sitting there in the Middle East and China. They're being put to work, building new infrastructure in both places, skyscrapers, power plants, power grids, roads, ports, and building middle classes that, while still relatively small, want all the things middle classes in advanced nations want. Cars, refrigerators, houses, and lots of stuff to fill those houses. All this spending on infrastructure and by emerging classes, in turn, is pulling in resources, goods, and services from the rest of the world, especially from other emerging economies. This means the world's developing nations are no longer nearly as dependent as they used to be on the United States and other developed nations to keep themselves going. Consumer spending is rising almost three times as fast in developing nations as in rich nations. Real capital spending is rising by double digits there, while it's rising only a bit over 1% a year in rich nations. And emerging economies' trade with each other is rising faster than their trade with richer nations. Is this decoupling of emerging from developed economies good news for America? Well, yes and no. Yes, to the extent that even as we fall into recession, developing nations will continue to demand our exports and generate good returns for American investors. But in another way, not such good news, because it means the price of many things we buy from developing nations, especially raw materials like oil, will continue to be high because of high demand there, notwithstanding a recession that reduces demand here. China's ever-increasing need for Middle East oil, for example, is pushing up its price and contributing to our slump.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Supercapitalism. Send us your thoughts about our Middle East coverage or anything else that strikes your fancy. We're online at marketplace.org. Dubai is not the only city in the Middle East that's growing. The war in Iraq has brought a building boom to the capital of Jordan, Amman. Iraqi businesses are relocating. Non-governmental organizations are setting up there. That's tightened the market for construction workers. But the men hanging out on street corners every morning looking for work aren't locals, which has turned a labor shortage into a regional problem. From Amman, Marketplace's Elisa Roth has a classic story of labor migration.
There are more than a dozen men climbing around in the freezing cold on the rebar and wood skeleton, which by spring will be another fancy house in posh West Amman. Unemployment in Jordan is high. Officially, it's 13%. Unofficially, it's closer to 30. Either way, not one of the men mixing concrete or cutting boards is Jordanian.
Mainly, we have Egyptian manpower.
Why?
Because this is very hard work. Jordanians, they are not interested in doing us hard work. That's true.
Tarek is Jordanian. He's the contractor who's building the house. He wouldn't tell me his last name.
Second thing, the manpower Egyptian is cheaper than the Jordanian. That's the reason. And among the Jordanians, you can't find the qualification which is available with the Egyptian.
Tarek later contradicts himself, saying he pays Jordanians and Egyptians the same, around $15 a day for unskilled labor, around $20 for skilled. But one thing is true. Look for a laborer in Jordan, and you'll most likely find an Egyptian. This is where the Egyptians first arrive in Jordan, a chaotic ferry terminal in Aqaba, a port on the Red Sea. Thousands of people pour off the boat, carrying enormous suitcases and parcels. Taxis and buses vie to take them to Amman and other cities. There, the men gather on street corners or in parking lots like this one, near a gas station in northwest Amman, to wait for work. Which doesn't always come. It's after 9 on a weekday morning, the time when many give up and go home to their crowded apartments. But today there's a good crowd, hoping somebody still needs a couple of men for the day. Aboud is one of them. He has short, dark hair and a 5 o'clock shadow. He carries a plastic bag of work clothes. Back in Egypt, he tells me, he and his father grew wheat, but they couldn't make enough money to survive. So 4 years ago, Aboud left his father to keep working the farm while he comes to this lot, getting work whenever he can, mostly laying bricks. He sends home about $200 a month, which doesn't sound like much. But if it wasn't worth it, he says, I wouldn't be here. And there are plenty of people who wish he weren't here, like Robia Said Ismail, who works in the gas station that owns the parking lot where the workers wait.
Especially in the morning, it's very disruptive to people who want to go to work. They want to get gas quickly, and sometimes they don't want to go to our gas station anymore.
Ismail says women complain the workers harass them, but the workers have been coming to this parking lot for years. And he doesn't have the heart or the nerve to try to boot them off. In any case, it's not clear the men are breaking the law by soliciting work this way. There are plenty of rumors about raids on work sites, but I watched a couple of police cars drive by without doing anything. Even so, the men find the rumors scary because their status is precarious. As of last spring, all foreign workers have to have permits. All the workers I talk to, of course, claim to have one. But if you ask a contractor like Tarek, nobody's looking too hard.
And do you check papers before you hire, or don't ask?
No, I don't check. It's not my problem.
Tarek's problem is finding capable workers at a good price, which he does by hiring Egyptians. In Amman, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Coming up, dry taps and tempers in Egypt.
People were putting up with too much to the extent that they exploded. It was like something you had that was boiling for a long time, and then you took off the lid.
But first, let's do the numbers. I got two words for you, gang. Bear and Stearns. News of a run on the investment banks at Wall Street. Well, it sent it to the wall today. Bayer said rumors that it might not have enough cash to meet its liabilities prompted many investors to ask for their money back. J.P. Morgan Chase and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York stepped in. They'll protect the bank for a month while it considers its next move. Bayer reports its numbers on Monday. That ought to be interesting. All of that said, the Dow Industrials fell 1.6% today, 194 points, to close at 11,951. The Nasdaq lost 2.25%, 51 points, to end at 22.12. The S&P 500 crumbled 1.9%, 25 points, to finish at 1290. For the week that was, the Dow is actually up 0.5%, the Nasdaq down 0.4%, the S&P 500 basically flat. Financials took a beating on that Bear Stearns news, as you might imagine. The Bear lost a whopping 47%. J.P. Morgan dropped 4%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. Middle East reporting on Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. And by Cleveland Clinic, expanding globally and committed every day to providing innovative treatments and hope to patients worldwide. Online at clevelandclinic.org. Want to know what our hosts and reporters experienced? You'll find their stories, insights, and observations from their travels in the Middle East. Head to marketplace.org and look for the staff blog in the Middle East at Work section.
The Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries was created in 1960. Part of OPEC's mission is to get a regular supply of petroleum to consumers. On this day in 1983, OPEC cut the price of its crude oil for the first time by a whopping 15%. But it couldn't do that today. Oil prices these days are set by movements in three international petroleum exchanges. Rising prices there make for more pain at the pump here. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace in the Middle East at Work. I'm Kai Rizdal in Dubai, the UAE. Next week marks the fifth anniversary of the war in Iraq. 5 years on, the United States is still divided over whether the best hope is a political solution or more troops on the ground. But what if the answer is an economic one? Harvard historian Neil Ferguson says that could happen. In his most recent book, The War of the World, he says economic instability leads to conflict, but viable market economies can end it, especially, he says, in the Middle East.
I don't think it's a mystery that the Middle East is the danger zone in the world today, just as Central and Eastern Europe were the big danger zone of the mid-20th century. It's a rather similar place. If you look at income levels, the Middle East is about where Central and Eastern Europe were 100 years ago. If you look at the degree of ethnic disintegration, the potential for ethnic conflict, it's strikingly similar. That was the great fulcrum of 20th century conflict. My fear is that the Middle East will be the fulcrum of 21st century conflict.
I'd be curious then about your thoughts on the relationship between a functioning free market economy in the Middle East and democracy there.
Well, there's no simple relationship, and in many ways it's intermediated by civil society and by the emergence of a middle class, which is sufficiently educated and sufficiently prosperous to be willing to make democracy work. It's not enough, to put it really simply, to show up in a country, topple the bad guy, hold an election, proclaim the privatization of the economy, and go home. That's not the way the process works. In fact, if you look at the lessons of history, they clearly indicate that the transition towards a market economy and the transition towards a functioning democracy are quite gradual and intertwined processes that need quite a lot of luck, as it were, to succeed.
If your analysis holds and economic volatility leads to conflict, does it then hold that economic stability can resolve those conflicts?
It certainly helps. We've lived through a period of very low economic volatility since the 1980s. Of course, August came, and we are now back in the realm of quite serious financial volatility.
Well, let me translate it to the present situation in Iraq and ask you, What might have to happen in terms of economic stability there for the U.S. to be able to detach itself and for there to be political stability?
A huge amount still has to happen before we can talk about U.S. withdrawal. I think one needs to be absolutely clear about how far away Iraq still is. It takes a long time to go from anarchy, which is essentially where much of Iraq has been since the overthrow of Saddam, to anything resembling economic and political stability. And it's going to be very hard indeed to persuade the many Iraqis who fled the country, most of whom were, of course, the educated and wealthy Iraqis, to return. Without some kind of human capital and real financial capital, there isn't going to be much investment. All the Iraq economy is at the moment is a fairly precarious gasoline station which pumps out crude oil. There isn't a whole lot else going on. And so it's going to take years, I think, of very careful American nurturing for the situation there to stabilize enough that people will want to invest in companies and start building up a market economy there. This is not going to happen overnight, and we should all be realistic about that.
The book by Neil Ferguson that got us talking to him in the first place is called The War of the World. He is also the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor at Harvard University. Professor Ferguson, thanks so much for your time.
Guy, it's been a pleasure.
Any list of the challenges facing the Middle East has to start, and maybe it has to end, with the most basic one. It's dry here, really dry. That affects where people live, and it affects how they live. In Egypt, 90% of the land is desert, so the vast majority of the population is crowded into the Nile Valley surrounding Cairo. Egypt's adding more than 1 million people a year. That puts huge strains on its natural resources, strains that are evident every time some people turn on the tap. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Trash lines the streets of this village in Giza, outside Cairo. Shops sell mobile phone cards, snacks, toilet seats. Water collects in muddy pools from leaky pipes in the ground. But Manel Mahmoud says in the houses here, there isn't a drop to drink.
For 5 months, we had no water. Now it's starting to come out, but by nighttime, the water that comes out of the tap is sewage.
Down the street, others say they haven't had clean water in a year. Mohammed Amran is a plumber. He says he scrounges for water at nearby coffee shops or borrows from neighbors.
We stay up all night looking for someone who has clean water we can have.
The Cairo-based Center for Rural Studies says roughly 5 million Egyptians live without sufficient access to clean drinking water. That's about 6% of the population. Last summer, thirsty residents staged protests throughout the country. Mohammed Nagy heads the Hobby Center for Environmental Rights. He says at one point, demonstrators shut down a major highway.
People were putting up with too much to the extent that they exploded. It was like something you had that was boiling for a long time, and then you took off the lid.
The protests may have worked. Mohe El Serafi is a spokesman with the government-funded holding company for water and wastewater. He says there's plenty of water to go around, but the company ran out of money to purify and deliver it. After the protests, El Serafi says the government kicked in about $450 million to build new pipes and fix old ones.
Now, since the funds are available, finally, by the 30th of June, this problem will be totally eradicated, so there won't be a single village in Egypt suffering any shortage of water.
Not a single village? When I ask El Serafi about the sewage coming out of the tap in that neighborhood in Giza, he points at my cup of tea.
The proof that our water is totally clean and it's never mixed with sewage water is that actually you are using it to drink right now.
But I'm not in Giza.
لا الجيزة اللي بيشتكوا ديت في مناطق مش تبعنا.
Unfortunately, those other parts on the suburbs of Giza, they don't belong to us. They are not under our responsibility.
That's because many developments, like the one I visited, are unlicensed. They were built illegally to accommodate the legions of Kyrenes who can't afford proper housing. El Serafi insists even unlicensed neighborhoods will have water by early summer. In Giza, Shoaib Taha Shoaib turns on the tap in his kitchen.
You cannot even take a bath with this because it will spoil your hair and your skin. It is too salty.
Shoaib is lucky. He has a job and can haul containers of drinking water home from the office.
I work in the government, and there's a car that takes me to and from work. That's how I get water to my house. But the rest of the people are too poor to have a car, and they are suffering with this lack of potable water.
Shoaib has lived here too long to trust the government's promises, just like the ring road built recently to carry drivers past the slums here to fancier neighborhoods. He worries the new water project will pass them by. In Giza, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Amy brought her camera along with her to Cairo. We've got pictures online at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, working toward energy independence with 10 billion transit trips per year at publictransportation.org. And by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
The air here in Dubai this morning was thick. Some strange combination of sand blowing off the desert, dirt from the construction sites, and fog coming in off the Persian Gulf made it hard to see more than a couple of hundred yards ahead. I know this is an imperfect analogy, but that's kind of the problem we've been having the past 2 weeks. We came here to figure out whether business can change the Middle East. In Egypt, in the northern part of the region, where we spent our first week, crowded old cities and religious differences make even the simplest transactions a contest of wills. Down here in Dubai, they all but say, please, come, spend your money, start your companies, pay no taxes. That seems to have worked the way Dubai wants it to, so far. Still, my lasting memory of this city is going to be its incompleteness. Not just physically, although that for sure, but also because for all the building and booming, Dubai's place in the global economy still isn't a sure thing. Too many people here are being left behind. And I get a sense that a lot of the rest of them are here because they're afraid to miss out on something. They just don't know what yet. So, can business change the Middle East? Sure, and it already has. We just don't know how much more change there's going to be. That's Dubai, and that is Marketplace. Nancy Fargali produced our special coverage, The Middle East at Work. She had help out here on the road from Ravi Carmen, Eric Johnson, Miguel Macias, and Amy Scott. Megan Larson produced for us in Los Angeles. She had help on engineering from Chris Clark. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. J.J. Yore is our executive producer. Our theme music, composed by B.J. Lederman, was arranged this week by Benjamin Harbert. A very special thank you to everybody back home who helped make these broadcasts possible. It was a lot of work by a lot of people. You can see a full list of their names on our website. It's marketplace.org. Live one last time from Dubai, I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourself a great weekend.
وسائل الإعلام الأمريكية.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.